Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where you would normally hear Rich Lowry and Andy McCarthy discuss the latest legal and national security issues. Rich is out this week, so you're hearing me, Noah Rothman, instead. This week, we will discuss Trump's civil fraud verdicts and his upcoming criminal trials, the Biden family in the dock, and Russian spycraft of such intrigue it rivals a Cold War novel. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star review it and he deserves on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this podcast none other than its eponymous host, Andy McCarthy. Andy, how are you?
Noah, I'm doing great. How are you?
Very good, sir. Although I'm a little confused, and I'm going to need you to hold my hand through all this. So let's start with the New York civil fraud trial. Judge Arthur Engoron last week found Donald John Trump liable for inflating the value of his assets and defrauding investors, even though those investors seem to have been perfectly satisfied with their loans. Nevertheless, $355 million with interest around $450 million barred from doing business in New York for 3 years. What are the contours of this verdict for me and other non-lawyers who are just wrapping our hands around this thing?
Well, it was expected. It comes at the end of an 11-week trial, and then another month or so, I think we waited for Engoron to render his ruling. And it's interesting, Noah, that it's Engoron who's rendering the ruling. I think one of the issues that will come up on appeal is why this was a bench trial. They ended up with a bench trial in front of an elected progressive Democrat judge, who was pretty hostile to Trump from the beginning. The main gravamen of the case is that Trump alleged, and there's pretty compelling evidence to support this, that he inflated the value of his assets for purposes of getting loans and insurance coverage and the like. He was prosecuted in part under a consumer fraud statute that the context of which is usually an allegation of persistent fraud committed by a business that's dealing with small dollar consumers. So it's kind of like a class action in the sense that no one person has the incentive to bear all of the burdens and financial pain of doing litigation. So this is a method for the state to come in and go after somebody in that situation who defrauds consumers. Here, according to the Associated Press, the first time ever, and this goes back, I guess, 70 years, this statute was used against Trump in the context of dealings between sophisticated financial actors on each side of the transaction, where it would be expected that both sides do, their own due diligence. And as a result, with all of the allegations that Tish James, the attorney general, made here, there were no victims. And in the main fraud count, which is section 6512 of the New York business law, it's a monstrous statute in this context, no requirement even to prove intent to defraud. And at the end of 11 weeks, at the beginning of the trial, before the trial even started, Judge Engoron found that Trump was liable for fraud. So really the trial, which in part was about the other six causes of action in the case, besides the first big one on this overarching fraud count, really what the trial was about was how much Engoron was going to let Tish James run up the score in terms of a financial penalty to Trump on a theory of what they call disgorgement, because they couldn't show any individual fraud victim. The idea was that the state was going to take from him his ill-gotten gains. And as Judge Engoron explained, the law under the statute doesn't require a victim, and all it calls for is for the fact finder, in this case the judge, to make an assessment of how much the defendant earned by means of falsity and misrepresentation, whether anyone right. else thinks they were harmed.
Right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not just the monstrous size of this judgment, but the fact that they're prosecuting this at all, that's kind of abnormal, that has the high-dollar business community in New York up in arms.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, two things on that score. First, people should remember that this is the case that the prosecutors looked at in New York and decided not to bring. It was originally an investigation by my old office, the Southern District of New York, on the federal side. They decided to abandon it. It was picked up by Cy Vance, who was then the attorney general, Manhattan district attorney, right? He was ultimately replaced by Alvin Bragg when Bragg was elected. But they made two trips up to the Supreme Court to compel Trump to turn over his financial records, thinking, I think, that this was going to be the mother load of a big financial RICO case that my old criminal division chief, Mark Pomerantz, was brought into the DA's office to try to build. And then when they got finally access to Trump's records, I think they recognized, even though Pomerantz wanted to go forward with the case, Alvin Bragg, who isn't embarrassed even to bring the hush money case against Trump, looked at all this and decided there was no case there. There was no fraud case. And I think that's because they would have had to apply the penal law, which is more demanding and has a higher burden of proof. And there would have been a very high chance of, even in New York, of acquittal, they felt. So they passed on the case. Tish James then scooped it up, and she has the statute that the criminal prosecutors don't have the advantage of. And she also has the lower civil version of burden of proof of a mere preponderance of the evidence. So she decided to pick up the case and run with it. But interestingly, at the beginning of the case, she said her damages were $250 million. And then after 11 weeks of proving no victims, she said at the end she thought her damages were actually $370 million. And essentially, Judge Engoron, who was a rubber stamp for her throughout the case, pretty much gave her everything she asked for.
So let's talk about Trump team's prospects for appeal. In your piece, Trump's appellate prospects after ruinous civil fraud judgment, you outline why they're not horrible, but not great, those prospects. The idea here is they can seek the reduction of the penalty, but why? And explain this to me, because we have a judge here who essentially predetermined the outcome of this case in all but explicit terms. And sure, the Trump team, as I understand it, didn't seek a jury, but nevertheless, they could bring that up on appeal. And just the size of the verdict is just exorbitant. And, they're saying Eighth Amendment violation, who knows? But nevertheless, they got a case there. Why do you have a little bit more suspicion there? Then a layman would suspect that this would just be kind of open and shut.
So I did appellate litigation for a long time as a federal prosecutor. And what people need to understand about appeal, and this is simply how it works. Appellate courts are very reluctant to reverse findings of fact made by the trial court. The theory is that the trial judge, even in a jury trial, and here you have a situation where the judge was the jury, but the trial court observed the witnesses testify, saw the dynamic of the trial as it unfolded, and knows more about the evidence in the case, having made the evidentiary admissibility rulings than an appellate court does looking at a cold transcript. So if you're talking about conclusions of law, an appellate court has no reluctance at all about second-guessing a trial court. But if you're talking about conclusions of fact, whether it's made by a jury or, in this case, a judge, appellate courts generally will not touch the fact-finding unless it's utterly irrational, that it, you know, you can make a conclusion on the four corners of the page that it's, you know, that it's just off the charts wrong, which is unusual. So the reason, Noah, I think that the appellate prospects are not great here in terms of a sweeping win, and that's what I'm talking about, because what Trump would need here is a sweeping win. Like, winning a few things on appeal doesn't help him, because he could otherwise, based on the sweeping nature of this judgment, he could really be put out of business, even if he gets some relief on the financial end. And the thing is, Trump's main theory here, we could talk about what his legal claims are, but his main theory is that Engoron is just flatly wrong about the valuations on his property. One of the ones, and here's a good example, one of the ones that Trump has harped on the most, I think, is Mar-a-Lago, where he keeps saying that the judge valued Mar-a-Lago at only $18 million, and it may be worth, according to Trump, somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion. So he basically scoffs that Engoron came up with this number. And in point of fact, Engoron didn't come up with that number. That number, which is actually not 18 million, Trump lowballed it because it helps him rhetorically, but it was 18 to 27 million. And it's done by an independent assessor who, applying Florida law, assesses the value of the property in terms of all of the legal encumbrances that exist on the property. So Trump is talking about what Mar-a-Lago would be worth if he could sell it free and clear. And what the assessment is about is what Mar-a-Lago is worth if you had to buy it with all the restrictions that are on it so that Trump could get the tax breaks that he has down in Florida. So just take something like that. An appellate court is not going to reverse Judge Engoron's conclusion of what Mar-a-Lago was worth in terms of whether Trump outrageously overvalued it. So if an independent assessor is saying it was 18 to 27 million and Trump is using 4 or 5 times that amount in his statement of financial conditions, the appellate court is going to side with the judge on that, not with Trump. So if you're talking about other things like you just mentioned, like the jury trial, you know, there you got a shot at getting him to make a different legal conclusion. I cut you off.
No, because this is the evaluation, I think, that has you in hot water with Trump's legal team. Yes. One of his most visible attorneys, Alina Haba, took a lot of issue with your assessment in that piece, which everybody should go read. You were very charitable in your reaction to her assessment. She's just being a bulldog for her client. You know,
well, she's doing what she should do, and I'm trying to do what I should do, which is just try to be objective about it. And I thought I made pretty clear in the piece, I hope Trump wins. I would prefer, I don't really care so much about Trump, but I think it would be better for the business climate and the legal climate in New York, which I care a great deal about having come from there. I think it would be much better if Trump won the appeal. I just think, though, that we need to be realistic about what's achievable and what's not. He's got a few claims, I think, that could result in a complete reversal. One is the Eighth Amendment claim that has been bandied about. This is a very tough one, but basically the Eighth Amendment bans, in addition to cruel and unusual punishment, excessive fines, right? Yeah. And this fine seemed very excessive. Now, they will say that they have a formula that they rolled out during the trial. They had an expert witness come in and make an assessment of how much Trump would have had to pay in terms of interest and coverage costs if he had honestly laid out what the value of his assets were. And then they compute you know, the value of the properties and the value of the loans and the coverage that he got. And they have this factor that they came up with in this appraisal of, you know, what the interest rate should have been rather than what it was. And they multiply that by the loans, and that's how they get the disgorgement. To me, that's a dicey formula. So that might be, it seems very odd to me to think that, you have, for example, JP Morgan Chase or Deutsche Bank, who employ entire teams of people who do risk assessment and who didn't take Trump's word for it about what his assets were worth. They did their own appraisals. And if you want to tell me that, you know, New York State, which is not in this business, unlike Chase and Deutsche Bank, that New York State has an expert who's going to come in and he's going to do a better job appraising what the risk was than the people who actually had skin in the game. I think an appellate court might have a great deal of interest in that, because this is not like a straight factual finding. It's a very creative way to assess what the damages were. But I think in particular, given that there were no victims who came forward and a lot of people testified on Trump's behalf that they were happy to do business with him, that they do business with him again, and they all made money, it's going to be hard, I think, for New York to defend. You know, maybe Trump should have been fined $10 million for overstating his assets. You know, that I think that would be high, but that would be a lot more reasonable than $355 million with interest.
So it's hard for me to disentangle Haba's comments with Trump's comments and the politics of all this, and it's clearly a political football. But before we get to that, just briefly, I think you think that the financial hardship here is going to be close to prohibitive for Donald Trump. If I understand it right, to even appeal require is not a cost-free proposition.
Right.
And does he have it? I mean, if the shoes are any indication, if the gaudy shoes – to tell us anything about the state of his finances, it ain't great.
Tell me you didn't get yours yet? Are you kidding?
I haven't gotten my pair of gold Nikes yet. I think they might have sold out. Also, I think that would be the cost of a Florida vacation too.
My favorite part of that was the thing that said limit 3 per customer. I thought that was the best touch of all.
Not enough for the whole family.
Right. So here's where I think this – Rich and I have discussed this a number of times on the podcast, and my usual comment has been, as interesting as the criminal trials are, and they present a lot of very interesting issues, and they have a lot of potential risk for Trump in terms of imprisonment and, you know, just the stigma of conviction. But I always said don't go to sleep on the civil fraud case, because in terms of how Trump – you know, survives in terms of business and finance, it's an existential event for him. And that was when we were thinking the damages at most were $250 million. As it turns out, with interest, it's almost twice what it was at the beginning. So my point about this is not limited just to this case, although this case would be enough of a catastrophe if it was just by itself. But in the last year, he got a $5 million judgment against him in the first E. Jean Carroll case, an $83 million judgment in the second one, and now this $355 million with interest closer to $450 million. Unlike in criminal cases where you get an automatic appeal, in civil cases, you are expected to post the value of the judgment with the court. Because they want to make sure that you're not appealing just for purposes of delay, and that you will actually pay up if we give you an appeal and you lose, you have to pay, right? So that's what the theory is here. So Trump has had to put up about $6 million to appeal the $5 million verdict, because you have to do it with interest. He was liquid enough, as I understand it, to post that with the court. On January 26th, the jury in the second E. Jean Carroll case rendered the $83.3 million verdict. Trump has until it's 30 days to appeal. So Trump has until really, I think, the beginning of next week to decide whether he's appealing that. If he's going to do that, he's got to post about $90 million to do that. Now, you don't have to post it in cash. You can get a bond. You'll have to pay a significant amount of cash, but the bondsman is going to make you secure the rest of it with enough property that he can execute on it if you don't fulfill your obligations under the bond. So whether it's money or property, he's got to post it if he wants to appeal. And then now you have this appeal, which will require him to post. It's usually 120% of the judgment amount. So here they're already factoring in interest. I think we're conservatively talking $430 to $450 million that he would have to post in money or property. So if you put that all together, we're talking about tying up over $500 million in his assets. And it's not like this guy doesn't have other stuff going on. So for example, I think it was 2021, Forbes did an analysis of the big loans that he has due. And as I understand it, one of them, which is in connection in part with Trump Tower in Manhattan, he's got a $425 million loan that's either got to be paid or renegotiated this year. And the restrictions on the judgment obviously go much further than the financial penalty. The judge has said that basically he can't do business or take loans in New York anymore. But I think it's not going to be just New York, Noah, because like, what other bank is going to lend this guy that kind of money under these circumstances? And one of the things that came out—
the RNC.
Yeah, good luck. Imagine if they had $500 million, right? Maybe he should go to the DNC. Maybe they'll help him out. but, you know, I just think a number of these loans was proved in the trial. Trump was required to personally be the surety for loans that were given to the Trump organization. And the loan conditions on a number of them, the big ticket items, would be that he had to show that he maintained personal wealth of over $2 billion as a condition to get the loan. He may have been worth over $2 billion when he got those loans. Is he worth over $2 billion today? I don't know.
Yeah. So last one, because I don't want to go too long on this, but on the politics of it. So Trump was on Laura Ingraham, Fox News Channel, yep, where he called his treatment at the hands of Judge Engoron a form of Navalny, likening his treatment to the imprisonment of a Russian dissident in a Siberian labor camp where he mysteriously died. Seems qualitatively distinct to me. Nevertheless, a form of the populist argument, they're coming after me to get to you. So why should I too believe that I'm at risk of this sort of treatment, inflating the value of my $10,000 penthouse in Manhattan and defrauding my investors? I'm struggling to put myself in the gentleman's shoes.
Yeah, well, now that they've crashed that glass ceiling, maybe they will come after you too. I mean, somebody had to be the first case. But you know,
but let's take it seriously. You know, on the prospects of obviously the government can ruin you with a frivolous accusation.
Yep.
And the penalties for that kind of abuse are hard to pursue unless you're very liquid and have a lot of money at your appeals or your disposal. So where's the truth in that?
I would say two things about it. Number one, to the extent that people think that Trump is the only person that this could happen to, which seems to be what the New York officials are saying, including Kathy Hochul, who the governor, who tried to convey that message in her comments last week, even though you have a lot of big business people who are saying, if I can get out of New York, I'm getting out of.
So, but I'm sorry I'm interrupting you, but yeah, I want to chase that one down too, because Trump is essentially arguing that this is the government essentially going after him and him alone, as though it's an act of attainder, a bill of attainder. This is obviously a shot that's bad for business, but if that argument takes hold, it would have a perverse effect of soothing frayed nerves, right? They're going after me because I poked my head up above the parapet. Unjust though that may be.
Yeah, but I still think that having done it now and shown that it works, and it looks to me like it's going to work. I mean, we'll have to see how the appeal floats out. But, you know, Trump may be the personal embodiment of everything that New York Democrats hate, but he's not the only embodiment. You know, they don't like gun manufacturers. They don't like fossil fuel businesses. They don't like a lot of stuff. And I think that the thing, Noah, that has importantly changed about New York, and I want to say the legal culture, but I think it's the broader culture as well. In the 80s and 90s, when I was a prosecutor in New York and Bob Morgenthau for a million years was the district attorney in Manhattan, it would have been disqualifying to go to the electorate because the state officials are elected, right? They're not, we federal guys were appointed, they're elected. It would have been disqualifying in the culture of that time to go to the electorate and say, if you put me in office, if you elect me, I will use the power of the office against our X, Y, and Z political enemies. Now, fast forward to, I don't know when Tish James first ran, I want to say like 2017, 2018, something like that. She campaigned promising to use the power of the office against Trump. And she won in a landslide. Alvin Bragg, as part of his campaign, now, you know, understanding that not a lot of people, you know this stuff better than I do, not a lot of people vote in the DA's election, right? They probably got more voters this year because the mayor election was on the same day. But, you know, that was a broad field. I think he won with something like 50,000 votes. It wasn't enormous. But his campaign was, when I was a New York state official, I sued Trump more than any other state attorney. So I think what's changed culturally is there was a center left and right in New York that made up the heartland of the legal culture for decades. And it was expected that you would, even if people didn't do this, it was at least expected that you would represent, that you would enforce the law with no fear or favor, that it would be even-handed, that we believed in equal protection of law. I don't think progressives are on that program. I think they have no problem with the idea of using the power and the processes of the state against their perceived political enemies. And that's now an ascendant philosophy. And we have to get used to the fact that that's just the way it is. I don't think the Navalny thing is helpful to Trump. I remember when we were doing the Blind Shake case, it occurred to somebody on our team that, you know, Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, Kampf in German, as I understand it, means struggle, which is the same thing that jihad means. So somebody suggested that in one of our jury addresses, we make an analogy to what to the Sheikh's writings and Mein Kampf. And we ended up pushing back on that and saying that was not a great idea, just because you don't want to do those kinds of, you know, that regime is historically uniquely evil, and those kind of comparisons just are not helpful. And I feel the same way about Navalny. I can detest what's happening to Trump here, even though I don't have a lot of personal sympathy for Trump, but I think with the Lawfare campaign in general is detestable, and it's breaking norms that we're going to regret are broken. I think you can make that point without the Navalny comparison.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about the implications of this sort of thing, that nothing happens in a vacuum. And if deterrence has broken down in that sense, and progressives perceive themselves to be at liberty to persecute their political adversaries through the law, you can expect the same thing to happen to Democrats in Republican-led slates with Republican DAs, and it would just be, you know, to break a seal that we certainly don't want broken. Let's pivot now to the president and his family. The president's brother, Joe Biden, was on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying around some of the issues involving him and Hunter Biden and the corruption allegations that are swirling around the president himself. National Review news writer James Lynch has a very good piece on this. 5 major questions lawmakers should ask Joe Biden's brother. I urge you to go read it. Why don't we get a brief update on where Jim Biden fits in this milieu of scandal before we get to the big fun stuff around the Soviet intrigue that has apparently overtaken the American legal class. Let's start with Jim Biden and try to help me understand why, for example, he feels like he needs plausible deniability.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that one of the things that it's important to start with on this, Noah, is that when you're dealing with political actors and political corruption type cases, and I saw this a number of times as a prosecutor in political corruption cases, what you need plausible deniability for or from is not necessarily criminal activity, although it could be criminal. The thing that political people, especially those who have ideas about potentially running for even higher office, as Biden did in the years after the Obama administration, is it would be bad for Biden to be seen as in a business partnership with apparatchiks of the Chinese Communist Party, whether or not it was illegal. So, you know, a lot of the reason I think it's important to make the distinction between, you know, icky behavior and illegal behavior is because when these things start to unfold, those things get conflated, especially by people who are trying to defend the people who are suspects. So, for example, the Democrats keep saying there's nothing wrong. They haven't shown anything wrong. And what they mean by that, if you try to pin them down, is that the Republicans haven't come up with any proof that would enable a prosecutor to indict Biden for either bribery or some other kind of political corruption charge. But in terms of political authority and what the framers were worried about, for example, in enacting the impeachment clause, they weren't worried about crime. They were worried about the awesome powers of the presidency being purchased by foreign powers. That was one of their major concerns. So it's kind of neither here nor there whether somebody is actually guilty of a penal offense if what the big problem is, as the Republicans have been able to establish thus far, is that, for example, in the 5 years between 2014 and 2019, basically agents of corrupt and anti-American regimes managed to pay $24 million to either Biden family associates or Biden family members, usually through a series of Byzantine transactions using a lot of LLCs that anybody who is in the organized crime investigation business would recognize as the patterns of money laundering. It doesn't mean necessarily that there was money laundering, but that is pretty common. And the disturbing thing about these transactions, a slice of which Jim Biden got a good amount of money from, especially from the Chinese business partners of the Bidens, is when you look at big dollar transactions, it doesn't matter how big the dollar amount is if you can see an asset changing hands. Like money goes one way and the asset comes the other way, then you can see why that's a legitimate transaction. When you look at these transactions, there doesn't seem to be any asset changing hands. The money is going to the Bidens, but what is going in the other direction? And what seems to be the only commodity that's sensible that's at issue is access to Joe Biden and his political influence. And really, a number of the witnesses that the Republicans have called in this investigation have as much as confirmed that, including Devin Archer, who was Hunter Biden's partner, who basically said we were selling what they called euphemistically the Biden brand. And the idea was this is worth it to people to contribute to, not necessarily even to get him to do anything for them, so much as to be able to project the image that they are insiders, which has a discouraging effect on people who might otherwise investigate them or
right. Put them some. And the Democratic defense, as we understand it, is that was all a lie. It was just an illusion. So Hunter Biden, Jim Biden, everybody around him, Devin Archer, Bob Alinsky, they were all just con men.
Right.
Doesn't sound like a very effective defense, but that is what they're running with.
Yeah. And they have, the committee is pushing back with, first of all, there's no business without Biden. And as somebody who worked in government for a long time and had to deal with all the conflict of interest regulations and everything else, the thing that I find the most disturbing about this is that someone in Biden's position could have shut this down in 5 minutes if he didn't want it to go on. So, for example, let's take it from the Democrats' point of view, right? They have this big dinner in at the Cafe Milano in Washington in 2015, where Biden shows up, Joe Biden shows up, he's vice president at the time, and let's say he thought that he was meeting Hunter for dinner. And it turns out that he showed up, and there's a bunch of Hunter's business partners from all over the world there, including from Burisma, the corrupt oil company in Ukraine. So maybe he doesn't want to embarrass Hunter, right? And they have dinner, and they have the evening, and he hangs
around.
You
should react like Joe Pesci walking into Getting Made in that situation. That is where you turn around. Oh, no. Walk out.
Yeah, right. Well, that's exactly what you do. So let's say he doesn't want to embarrass his son, though. And they have the dinner, and it's all fine. As soon as he gets home, he's picking up the phone and saying, "Don't you dare ever put me in that position again. What are you, out of your mind?" And instead, what we hear is quite the opposite. What happened was Biden had many meetings with partners of Hunter. He made many phone calls. We've heard testimony from Devin Archer that the Burisma guys, the corrupt Ukrainian oil company, having paid Hunter millions of dollars to be on their board for when he has no skill set that would be value producing for Burisma, when they have their board meeting in Dubai. In I think it was late 2015, after the board meeting, they meet up with Hunter and Devin at a luxury hotel in Dubai, and they say, "We need you to get your father on the phone." And they actually do, Hunter does make the call, and they put him on the speakerphone. And they, you know, basically what Burisma is saying is, "We need help here. We need somebody from the American government to stop the prosecutors here from going after Zlochevsky, who was the head of Burisma, and the company." And 8 days later, Biden is in Ukraine as vice president. And by his own telling, he threatened the Ukrainian government that if they didn't fire the prosecutor, he was going to withhold $1 billion in American aid.
Right. And the Democratic defense to that is consistent with what was American policy at the time, that this prosecutor was a corrupt prosecutor. They wanted him out. Everybody wanted him out. That was above board. But Mykola Zlochevsky, Burisma, bribed the Bidens.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was what Hunter.
What else can you say about it?
Yeah. Well, here's what you could say about it. The minute Joe Biden wasn't vice president anymore, Zlochevsky slashed Hunter's compensation in half. You know, right. I mean, they weren't even subtle about what it was, and they paid him millions of dollars. I think it was like $3 million that they paid in the end. So is that prosecutable? It might be, but it's real. Whether it is or it isn't, it's really bad. And I think that when Jim Biden, for example, according to – now, I think he denies this – but according to Tony Bobulinski, who was brought in to build a corporate structure of this deal that they were doing with this Chinese, what turns out to be really a Chinese intelligence operation called CEFC. But Bobulinski says he's talking to Biden and says, like, "Aren't you worried this guy, he could run for president? This is not exactly a business deal that he wants to be in." And Bobulinski is very clear about this. He said, "Look, if I thought anything criminal was going on here, I wouldn't have been involved in it." So you're not talking about like Bobulinski's worried that he's involved in some kind of a criminal fraud. What he's basically saying is, I'm just a guy trying to make money. It's not illegal in this country to do business with the Chinese, but it's not good for a politician who has aspirations for high office to be doing business with the Communist Party of China. And it was in that context that Jim Biden said, according to Bobulinski, plausible deniability in connection with Biden. It wasn't necessarily that they were trying to have plausible deniability because they thought they were doing something criminal. It's because they knew they were doing something that was really sleazy. It was corrupt. It was self-dealing. That doesn't necessarily make it a prosecutable public corruption case, but it's very disturbing.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Okay, now let's pivot to the fun stuff. Alexander Smirnov, who last week was an FBI confidential source, and according to court documents filed this week, he admitted that, quote, officials associated with Russian intelligence were involved in passing the stories about Hunter Biden to the government. They got laundered into the political conversation. They're a part of these accusations that Republicans have been levying against the Biden family, and some on the left are now declaring absolute victory that this was all a compromat operation, even though Hunter Biden's laptop was verified, the contents of it were verified by the FBI and I think the IRS. Nevertheless, they're saying this guy's the star witness and he's just collapsed, therefore the case has collapsed. Now, Jim Jordan did submit a letter for a request for an interview with a State Department official saying, naming Alexander Smirnov in the documents, and subsequently withdrew that letter and then replaced that information and just dropped the name of this particular informant. But by no means was he a star witness or the key to this case. Are Democrats just sort of flailing here? I mean, this feels like 2016. It's got all the flavor of a 2016. What have the Russians got on Hillary Clinton? What have they got on us? I feel like John Podesta is going to jump out of the woodwork any minute now, you know, say my emails. Help me untangle this.
Well, it is 2016, and it's a lot like 2019. And I actually think 2019 is probably what locks it in, because the Democrats' story, if you recall, during the Trump impeachment of the Ukraine impeachment of 2019, was that the Biden Burisma corruption claims that were hot and heavy back then, and that were a major part of the, you know, Trump's pushback on the impeachment. Their view of it and what they want, or at least their story about it, was that it was Russian disinformation, and that Rudy Giuliani was the one who was doing all the investigation in Ukraine, and he basically had been had by Russian disinformation, and that Rudy was the source of all of the bad information about the Bidens, and he was being played by Russian intelligence. Now, that story went so far that the FBI actually pushed on the social media companies to suppress information about Hunter Biden on the theory that the laptop story was Russian disinformation. And they did that even though the FBI had the laptop for over a year and had subjected it to forensic testing and knew that it was not Russian disinformation, but they still suggested it to the social media companies. And of course, we also had that letter from the 51 former security officials conveniently put out like a couple of days before the foreign policy debate between Biden and Trump, which Biden relied on to try to dismiss the allegations as Russian disinformation. So this idea that this all is Russian disinformation is something that's been baked in the cake really since 2019 for sure. And I think that's the background.
Well, there's so much more meat on the bones now, though.
Yeah.
The notion that this alone would break up this case is bizarre. It's all but been confirmed.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look at what they have, I actually think this is kind of I don't want to use the word stupidity, but I can't help but believe that this is what it is.
A fine word, and it has a useful place.
Well, yeah, and I think it may be apt here because Chris Wray, the FBI director, fought tooth and nail when the congressional committees tried to get this document about Smirnov, which is called the 1023 form. Right, this is the standard FBI form for basically debriefing a, you know, reporting the and recording the statements made by a confidential human source. And a confidential human source is a bureau term of art for basically an informant that they sign up because they find him to be credible and useful, and they use him in various investigations. And according to the FBI, up until 5 minutes ago, this guy was a very useful, highly credible informant. That's what they said about him. And if this story that Weiss is telling in this indictment, David Weiss being the quote unquote special counsel, I always have to say faux special counsel with him because he's not legally entitled to credit. He doesn't have the credentials to be a special counsel under the regs. But be that as it may, if the story he's telling is true, it'd be interesting to see if the Justice Department and the FBI notify the courts and defense lawyers in all the cases that this guy helped them make. That, you know, gee, never mind those convictions, because it turns out that we built the case on somebody who turns out to be a complete fraud. But this is a very peculiar situation. And I think what happened was Ray told Jordan and Comer, the chairs of these committees that were pushing this investigation, you know, look, this is uncorroborated informant information. He didn't want to turn over the report. He only really turned over the report because he understood that a whistleblower had given it to, I think, Senator Grassley. So he figured the cat was out of the bag, so he shared the report with them. He pleaded with them not to go public with it, in part because they hadn't corroborated the information, and in part because it's really bad to go forward with informant information because the Bureau has to convince informants that we can maintain their confidentiality and protect them. So when you run out publicly and you do this sort of thing, that undermines what the Bureau's message is in trying to get cooperation from people. But nevertheless, these guys took this report, and because it said that Zlochevsky had told the confidential human source, we now know to be Smirnov, that he had bribed Biden and Hunter, both, you know, Joe and Hunter, $5 million apiece, $10 million, and that he had done it in such a Byzantine way that it would take 10 years for an investigator tracing all the leads to figure it out. And they thought that, you know, look, this matches up with the evidence that we've already gathered. Sounds like it's credible. It's millions of dollars coming into the Bidens. It's allegedly a transaction that's structured in a very strange way to make it difficult to trace. We're going to run with it. And you know, Ray told them they were making a mistake. They did it anyway. And the problem is now, assuming that this guy is, that his story was a complete lie, which is what Weiss alleges, the problem the Republicans have for themselves is they've taken a witness that they didn't need and who was not essential to the story, but they like the add-on that he gave to them because it kind of it was consistent with what they had otherwise proved. Now that he's blown up, what the Democrats are trying to create in the public mind is the idea that the whole case is blown up because this witness has. In the meantime, 95% of the evidence that's been collected with respect to Burisma has absolutely nothing to do with Smirnov.
Yeah, I don't begrudge Democrats that messaging strategy, but it is its own form of Navalny, as it were.
Yeah.
You're just arguing in order to, you know, change the facts on the ground in the court of public opinion, which has no bearing.
Yeah, well, but Noah, think about it this way. What else is this about other than the court of public opinion, right?
Sure.
Biden's never going to be prosecuted, and he's never going to be impeached. I mean, he may be. I don't think they'll ever have the votes to impeach him. They barely had the votes to get the inquiry over the finish line, right? So they're never going to impeach him. And the main reason, I actually think what they should have done, because I thought Comer was doing a pretty good job on this, they should have just left this in the oversight committee and let them continue to build their case, which in terms of what they're trying to achieve, which is political accountability, I thought they were doing a pretty good job. But the thing is, you have Trumpies in Congress who like the idea of having a parallel investigation. While Trump is running the gauntlet of all these civil cases and criminal cases, they want to have something going on in Congress that's a parallel proceeding that they can call impeachment and fill with the rhetoric and the atmospherics of public corruption, so that they're going on at the same time. And Trump has a political argument to say, well, I may be bad, but he's even worse than I am, or, you know, something to that effect. So to me, this is all about the court of public opinion, right? Because there isn't anything else that's really ever going to come of it.
Fair enough. All right, let's go back to Trump real quick before we get out of here, because we're going to have a criminal trial next month for Donald Trump. Maybe his best, if you can call them best, but it's Alvin Bragg's trial, the prosecution for the hush money to erotic actresses. In your piece, Alvin Bragg prepares criminal version of A.G. James' civil annihilation of Trump. You declare, quote, D.A. Bragg's prosecution is the most rigged thing I have ever seen. Now, we know the basic outlines of this. Bragg performed prosecutorial prestidigitation to get the case before his courts, spun one transaction out into 34 felony counts. Now, one of the things I like about your writing, and I think it's extremely valuable, and it dovetails with my approach to these cases, is you're kind of two minds on this thing. The first is that these are real acts of straining the law, straining your jurisdictional authority in order to get after Trump. But the second is, and this can be reduced to throat clearing, and it probably shouldn't be, of course he did it. I mean, of course he did. Obviously he did it. But at the same time, you know, this is a little excessive, or perhaps a bit too much. I don't think it should be reduced to throat clearing. I think it should be prominently featured that the guy has played fast and loose with the law, run afoul of statute, perhaps. But nevertheless, this particular prosecutor, Bragg, is not exactly a stickler for enforcement. So his, you know, approach to this is conspicuous. But you don't believe that's sufficient to scuttle the case? Just assumptions about the New York jury pool or the facts of the case?
Well, my main thing is I think Alvin Bragg has his own Judge Engoron in Juan Merchan, who we're going to know a lot more about in the next 2 months. But he is going to be the presiding judge in Trump's criminal trial that you just described, which is scheduled to start on March 25th. But he issued last week a 30-page pretrial order which rejected all of Trump's motions to dismiss the indictment. And it looked to me, reading that essentially Merchan is going to be a rubber stamp for Bragg. And he has bought whole hog all of Bragg's theories about why he should be allowed to bring this case, why it's still alive within the statute of limitations. To me, the most outrageous part of it, there's a lot here that's outrageous. And in particular, you just mentioned the taking one misdemeanor business falsification transaction and turning into 34 felonies. In any prosecutor's office, you would only prosecute the misdemeanor if you charge that against other people as a matter of routine. There's Justice Department regulations that tell prosecutors don't stack up the counts. You know, if you need five counts to get an adequate amount of prison time, that's how you should do an indictment. But you don't carve something that ought to be one thing into 34 things as a way, not so subtle, to suggest to the jury, this must be a really bad guy if the government dumped 34 counts on him, which is exactly what Bragg has done here. But I think the most outrageous part is New York law says that this business records falsification can become, which is a 2-year statute of limitations, can become a felony with a 5-year statute of limitations, which becomes 6 years because of COVID, if you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the guy intended to conceal another crime by falsifying his records. And the other crime that Bragg is relying on is basically federal campaign finance violations. And the problem with that is Bragg doesn't have any authority to enforce federal campaign finance violations. And his theory for doing it here is incoherent because he says this case ought to be brought the way he has brought it because Trump used these hush money arrangements to steal the 2016 election. In other words, he was concealing this stuff and
from voters.
Right. And what Bragg wants you to believe is if he had complied with the campaign finance laws, then this information would have been made aware to the public and Hillary would have been elected in the squeaker election that we had in 2016. So the problems with this are manifold, beginning with the fact that Trump's reimbursement to his former fixer, Michael Cohen, which is a pre-existing debt. Cohen is the one who laid out the money for this hush money arrangement with Stormy Daniels. That's not a campaign finance. That's not a political donation under federal law. If you believe that it was, what you'd be saying is that it would have been okay for Trump to pay the hush money to the porn star with campaign funds, which I think if he had done that, Bragg would have indicted him anyway, right, on the opposite theory. But the reason this is really incoherent is Cohen makes this payment in October of 2016, before the election. If this had been a disclosable campaign expenditure, Trump would have had to report it in the next reporting period, which would have been in 2017 after the election was over. So even if it was campaign finance, the public would not have found out about it until 2017, until after the election. So none of this makes any sense. But I think John Yoo makes the best constitutional point, which is it's up to the executive branch of the United States, the Justice Department, and the Federal Election Commission, which Congress has established basically to police federal campaign finance laws, to enforce those laws. And if a state prosecutor uses those laws in a way that the Justice Department and the FEC wouldn't under federal guidelines, he's basically usurping the executive branch's enforcement authority. And he's got no power to do it because it's not his law. But, you know, Judge Merchan completely bought Bragg's theory on this, and the case is going to go forward. And if you read Judge Merchan's opinion, it's kind of like reading Judge Engoron's pretrial opinion in the civil case. You come away with the idea that, the only mystery here is whether he can convince the jury to convict, because it looks like the judge is going to put his thumb on the scale.
On at least one count. All right. So let's put on your pundit hat. So we'll put a bow on this thing. This trial is going first. Because of the immunity case pending before the Supreme Court, which is delaying Judge Chutkan's proceedings on the special prosecutor's federal case on the January 6th stuff, the federal electors. So at first blush, you would say that this Donald Trump is the luckiest man in history. He just completely lucks out. Every turn of the draw seems to go his way, because all of us understand that this is built on a very flimsy foundation. But did the politics of this play differently when he's before a jury explaining why he made covert hush money payments to the erotic performers he was shtupping? I mean, it's the substance of the accusation he's defending himself against. And that informs, by the way, the assumption that this is a genuinely unjust proceeding. Nevertheless, it is the reality that we're going to live through. How does it play?
Yeah, I always feel bipolar with this kind of stuff, because on the one hand, I'm as put off by it as anyone, and I don't have trouble myself, because of what I used to do for a living, compartmentalizing the legal stuff from the political stuff. I think every one of these cases that we're talking about, Noah, whether it's Bragg's case or the Washington election interference case, or the Mar-a-Lago documents case, the Atlanta thing, I don't know what's going to happen with that circus. But just let's stick with those three. They all underscore that Trump is unfit to be president, which is like the most important and relevant thing in terms of the national interest here, right? There's no excusing the behavior in a kind of cosmic moral, ethical way. But my training is to assess this as how it's going to play in court as a trial. And in the criminal law, there's other assumptions. You know, in the political world, all you need to hear is it's Trump, and you know there's something fishy going on, right? In the four corners of a criminal trial, he's presumed innocent. And the only thing that's supposed to matter to the jury is what the specific charges are, what evidence got introduced at the trial, and how do the judge's legal instructions on what they're supposed to find at the end, how do those play out? I think these are very weak legal cases. But you're quite correct that whether they're weak legal cases or not, the facts that are going to come out are unsavory. And maybe if Trump can beat the cases, he'll be able to turn that into gold and say, see, the whole thing was all made up and they're after me and I'm being persecuted and I'm your, what did he say? I'm your retribution. Right. You know, maybe that'll work out for him. But
if it doesn't play that way, it's just because everybody knows that this is Trump. This is how he behaves. They've sort of compartmentalized his moral failings. But again, this is not a there but for the grace of God go I story, which is sort of what he's retailing.
But I think here what you would assess about this. I mean, I could say how I think the trials will come out. It looks to be like he's going to get convicted in New York based on what the judge has done on at least one count, and the logic of the indictment, since it's taking one thing and parsing it into 34. If he gets convicted on one, the chances are the final number of convictions going to be a lot closer to 34 than one, right? But in terms of how it plays, I think you're more of an expert than I am to say what is the impact. Well, no, I'm serious. What is the impact? I mean, I understand the polling is that if he gets any felony conviction, there is a material diminishment of his support in the states that are apt to decide the election.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's aspirational on the part of people who are responding to polls, that they really want to not support somebody who's been convicted of a felony conviction, but they will rationalize themselves into it anyway. I don't think that is true of everybody. There's a substantial portion, particularly among female voters, who are high propensity voters, yeah, who will look on this with disgust. And it may, you know, hurt him in the long run, sure, on the margins, but the margins will matter in a very close election.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the dynamic of this has always been, which is why I think it was it's sinister, but it was a brilliant plan by the Democrats. This was always going to help Trump with the Republican electorate. And we now know that the, you know, beginning with Bragg's indictment, it really ended the contest. But by the time these trials came around, the audience was not going to be the Republican electorate anymore. It's going to be the general public, where Trump is much less popular than he is in the Republican electorate. And even if it only hurts him by a couple of points, a couple of points in this election might be everything.
Andy, thank you so much for your time and helping me unravel a lot of things I didn't understand. I still don't understand them, but I know them better now than I did when we started an hour ago. Andy, I really appreciate it. That is all the time
we have. Thank you so much, Noah.
My pleasure. That is all the time we have today. You have been listening to a National Review podcast, which has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Rich will be back next week, and we'll see you then.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.